Hello everyone and welcome to the MEMSA second podcast. In today's episode, we are going to be sharing a recorded version of the IP Management, Collaboration and Commercialization Workshop that we hosted last year on the 3rd of December 2020. The presentation was made by Yetane, a director from National Intellectual Property Management Office, NIPMO.
Much for this opportunity. We are very grateful to be part of this day today. I want to briefly run you through a few topics, and I'm making this as high level as possible, and I want to thank Freddie for that very useful introduction. It is unfortunately not possible to go into a lot of detail in an hour, but what I wanted to do with this presentation is to maybe just start picking your brain, maybe just thinking about certain things that you should consider, other things that you should not consider when dealing with intellectual property, thinking about IP ownership, and then when you are collaborating and partnering with your entities. So in short, I'm going to give an introduction and touch on the IP ownership and IP partnerships. So what is intellectual property? Intellectual property refers in the broadest term to the creation of the mind. Generally divided into two categories, namely industrial property, which includes our inventions, our marks and logos, and then copyright, which include literary work, artistic work, musical works, and computer programs. Intellectual property rights are the rights that is given over the creation of the mind. So let's say, for example, I have an invention. That is my intellectual property. The intellectual property right that I would obtain is a patent. Or let's say I've got a mark or a logo. That is my intellectual property. But the intellectual property right that I would obtain is a trademark. In summary, there is about 6 broad categories for intellectual property rights. As all of these are not applicable to the members, I'm going to mainly focus on patents and copyright in my presentation. But I want to take this opportunity to just run you through all of them, as some of it might be applicable in certain instances. So let's start off with patents. A patent protects the underlying invention that is new and innovative. Let's think about a coffee cup. What makes a coffee cup work? It is the fact that it can hold a liquid. It's not the fact that it looks pretty, that it is blue, that it's got an ear to make it easier to drink the coffee. The underlying invention is that it can hold the fluid. And that is what we want to protect in a patent. Not the way it looks, not the way that we describe it to be, the underlying invention. Copyright protects the words, the artistic expression, the musical annotations that we reduced to a material form. The third type of intellectual property right we have is a design. A design protects what we generally can see. It protects the outward appearance of an article. A trademark is probably the one form of intellectual property that we are most afay with. It is a logo, a slogan, or a word that distinguishes one goods and services from another. Think, for example, of the words Nando's and KFC. I'm sure everyone thought about chicken. But the chicken from Nando's is very different from the chicken from KFC. But just with the word, we were able to distinguish one chicken fast food restaurant from another. That's the power of a trademark. A fifth form of intellectual property rights is plant breeders' rights, where you can protect the right to produce, propagate, sell, or import a new plant variety. And then the final form of intellectual property is a trade secret. those smaller nuances that you can't necessarily patent and that you want to keep secret that gives you that competitive advantage. What we have to remember is that a product does not have one form of intellectual property rights. Let's, for example, use a tipper truck. A tipper truck will have a trademark, will be a cat, or it will be a Volvo truck. Then the hydraulic system to tip the body will be subject to potentially patent protection if it is new or inventive. Then how to use that hydraulic system has to be written down in a manual. That manual will be copyright protected. Let's assume we've got a new form of the cab that we want to protect because it can hold more. That will be protected by design protection. Or the tires, you know, those grooves that it is in tires to displace the water or to displace the mud, that can be a design protection. And then let's say, for example, you have got secret load-bearing software that you don't want to disclose. You can use that as a trade secret to give you the competitive advantage. So I hope that it is clear that with one product or one article, numerous forms of intellectual property can be applicable. But let's go in a bit more detail about a patent. As I've mentioned, a patent protects the technical principle or the underlying invention that is new, inventive, and has utility. You don't just get a patent by filing an application. Generally, it has to go through an examination by a patent office, and it has to adhere to certain requirements. South Africa does not have a substantive examination office. So if you file for a bicycle in South Africa and you pay the necessary fees and your documents are all in order, you will get a patent. However, as we all know, it's not necessarily enforceable. There are other countries that have examining patent offices and then will grant your patent if your invention fulfills all the requirements. The term of a patent is 20 years from the first filing, and you have to generally pay annual fees to keep that patent applicable. And then the rights that you get from a patent is a negative right. You have the right to exclude everyone else from making, using, exercising, or offering to dispose of, or importing that specific invention so that you can have the whole profit and advantage of that. But what does this exclude mean? So let's use our tipper truck again. If we have a patent for the hydraulic system, we exclude everyone else from using our patented hydraulic system. That doesn't mean that their truck can't have an hydraulic system. They just can't have ours that's patented. And so that is why we call it a negative right. What are these requirements that I was talking about? So in order for you to get a patent, you have to have three requirements. It has to be new, and this is an absolute novelty. In other words, it must not have been disclosed anywhere in the world, written or verbally. It must be inventive. When we talk about inventive, we talk about it needs to be not obvious for the person skilled in the art. When we talk about an engineering invention, it is your general engineer would be regarded as the person skilled in the art. And it should not be obvious for him. It is not for a person like me that's got no engineering background. And then third and last, it has to have utility. It must be applicable. That's generally not a difficult requirement to meet. What is excluded from patentability? You cannot patent a discovery, a mathematical method, a literary or artistic work, because that's generally protected under copyright. A scheme or a rule of performing a mental act or playing a game or doing business. You You will see in my next slide that I say that IP or patents are territorial in nature. So although you cannot get a patent for doing business in South Africa, you can get a patent for it in the US. So when you have an invention, it is always important to make sure that where you believe your network is, where you believe you want to work this patent, see what is patentable in terms of their law. IP law is generally the same, but there are some exceptions. You can't patent a computer program, and the words in the act is per se, because the source code is protected by copyright, but the underlying methods or the technical effect, that is patentable. And then the presentation of information, as this is generally protected under copyright. I want to leave you with a few points to ponder. You must be first to file, because you want your invention must be new. But you must be careful to file not too early, because as you would recall, you only get 20 years protection. If you file too early and it takes you too long to get to the market, your protection period will be very short. If you file too late, someone else might have filed for a patent that is very similar or exactly the same as yours, and then you've got no protection at all. So a very difficult balance to get. You have to remember the disclosures destroy your novelty. If you therefore go to a conference and you tell us about your fantastic new invention, you will disclose destroy your own novelty. Probably one of the most important things for me to put across is that there is no such thing as an international patent or a worldwide patent. Patents and intellectual property in general, they are territorial in nature. And you need to file for a patent in every country that you deem important. So let's say, for example, you have let's go to my background. If I've got a pharmaceutical compound and I want to manufacture that, we will go to India, as India is deemed the pharmaceutical manufacturing country of the world. We will, if we have AIDS medication, we would want to file in the countries where our medication will be used. So we will go look at the countries with the highest HIV rate and file in those specific countries. Unfortunately, no one has enough money to file in all the countries. So you need to have a business strategy to decide who are the countries that's going to manufacture my product. I need to protect there. Who are the countries where I would likely be able to sell my product? And you will file there. And the fourth thing that I want you to think about is, don't assume your invention is new. Do the necessary searches. Do a patent search. Do a literature and Google search before you go down a road that is costing a lot of money and shouldn't have been gone down to in the first place. Further points to ponder is, patents are a means. It's not the end. In actual fact, a patent is about roughly about 30 to 40 pages, and it's just a knock on the door. A patent protects your investment in development, and it allows you to knock on the door of people to say, I have a protected right. How do we take this forward? And then even if you may think that patents are not really important, or if you don't think it should be a priority, the companies that you are going to collaborate with might think it is important. And therefore, your strategy, if you are going to collaborate, needs to take that into consideration. And I want to use this example that I found. Is in 1929, Alexander Fleming and his team discovered penicillin. And as they thought that penicillin will save millions of lives, there was a strong feeling that all the work associated with developing this antibiotic should not be the subject of patent protection. And consequently, penicillin and the methods for producing penicillin were never patented. 10 years later, the use of bulk fermentation methods to make penicillin were developed in the US. These methods were patented, meaning that large-scale commercial production of penicillin now resided with US companies that developed these methods. A couple of years later, the team discovered and developed a cephalosporin group of antibiotics, a different type of antibiotic. And at the time, the National Research and Development Organization, which was responsible for commercializing these inventions, filed a patent application for these newly discovered antibiotics. And two charitable trusts were set up by the inventors to support research in this field. And what I wanted to show with this example is that even though you might think this is for the greater good and should not be patented, other people down the line will use your invention, will have, in this case, discover a new method to do bulk fermentation, and then you will be potentially excluded from using your own patent in the future. I want to move over to copyright. Copyright is probably one of the intellectual property rights that we work with on a daily basis. It is the rights given to authors for certain types of work, be it literary, artistic, or musical works, or computer programs. You don't have to go file for copyright. It automatically arises, except for a few exceptions like cinematographic films. The duration, depending on the type of work, is generally the life of the author, plus 50 years, and it affords the exclusive economic rights to authors to enable them to control the use, expression, and distribution of their creation. What are the requirements? It must be original. You cannot have copied it from somewhere else. And it doesn't have to be highly creative, but it must be your work. They call it the sweat of the brow. It must be in a material form. You cannot say that, oh, you know, I thought about this, or this is my idea. It needs to be written down on paper, on rock, or whatever, but it has to be in a material, physical form. And then, just as a, you know, best practice, when you do have documents that you want to indicate is copyrighted, always put the C with a circle around it, the date that you created it, and your name, surname, or the company's name. Thereby, it shows that this work is subject to copyright when someone else looks at the document and wants to refer to it. It's always very important to think of what is not copyrightable. And generally, as I've mentioned, an idea cannot be copyrighted. A method, generally, a system, or a fact cannot per se be copyrighted. Copyright law only protects the way in which a thing is expressed, not the underlying invention or the procedural method. Those are typically protected by patents law or trade secrets where applicable. I want to use this example of the telephone book. We had a company in the UK that produced the telephone book, and then a publishing house decided to take the names and telephone numbers, as was provided for in this telephone book, and redesign it. The UK court had to give consideration as to whether the names, addresses, and phone numbers in the telephone directory were eligible for copyright protection. And it found that although copyright was in the manner in which the content was arranged, the copyright did not extend to the details, which are facts, and hence facts were not copyrightable. Other forms of copyright that does not get copyright protection is generally official government works, such as political speeches. There's others as well, but I thought these were the most important. I want to go on to IP ownership. Generally, the rule is he who creates will own. Therefore, you that come up with the idea is generally the owner of that intellectual property. There's always exceptions to the rule. If you are employed, it depends on your contract of employment. Generally, employment contract states that all inventions or intellectual property are developed in the course and scope of their employment will belong to the employer. If you are contracted, it also depends on the contract. Generally, the person that commissioned the work is owns the copyright. So, for example, if we have a photographer that we want to take our photos with, generally we will own the copyright in that photos because we commissioned it, but it all depends on the contract. When we deal with intellectual property, which emanates from publicly funded R&D, so when we deal with, you know, generally universities and science councils like the CSIR, we have certain legislation that prescribes IP ownership. In the first instance, we have to look at the Intellectual Property Rights from Publicly Financed Research and Development Act, the act that my office is responsible for. And then secondly, we look at institutional IP policies. These are the policies that the universities, science councils, and the entities that we work with have in place to deal with their intellectual property. On a lighter note, an interesting question arose regarding authorship and ownership of a non-human taking a photograph and whether it was subject to copyright protection. As you can see, this beautiful selfie that was taken by a monkey belonged to a British nature photographer. He set up his photographic equipment, his cameras and everything, and the monkeys came to play with it and took this beautiful selfie that you see in front of you. These selfies were uploaded by Wikipedia onto its Wikimedia Commons site without the permission of the photographer, as it was believed that the author was a non-human and thence copyright did not subsist automatically in these images. Obviously, the photographer did not agree, and this went to court. And I just want to show you the different interpretations in countries. The US Copyright Office concluded that only works created by human can be copyrighted under United States law, which excludes pictures and artwork created by animals or by machines without human intervention. And that because copyright law is limited to original intellectual conceptions of the author, the copyright office refused the copyright in this photo. The UK Intellectual Property Office also gave consideration to the UK law and said that the question is whether the photographer owns the copyright is much more complex, and that it depends on whether the photographer has made a creative contribution to the work. And this is the decision that the court had to consider. Different views, but very interesting. I will encourage you to go read further onto the what has come after this with the monkey selfies. But let's go back to business. I want to talk about the IPR Act in a little bit more detail, as this is, I understand, Mensa works with universities and science councils, and publicly financed R&D comes into play quite a bit. So when does the IPR Act apply? Three questions need to be asked to know whether IPR Act applies. First one, was it created after 2 August 2010? That is when the Act came into force. Your answer is yes. We go to the next question. Was it as a result of an R&D activity? Your answer is yes. We go to the next one. Was the IP that was created using public funds? If your answer to all three of these questions is yes, then the IPR Act applies. If it is no to any one of these, the IPR Act and its provisions does not apply. We have a guideline on our website, the website is at the end, that puts this into a bit more detail. But the IPR Act provides for three IP ownership options or provisions. The first one is the default position, and this states the recipient that receives the public funds and undertake the R&D shall be the owner. So let's say, for example, CSIR. The CSIR receives money from the Department of Science and Innovation or National Treasury to conduct R&D. They conduct the R&D themselves. They will therefore be regarded as the owner of that intellectual property. The second ownership option that we have is co-ownership. A private entity or organization may become a co-owner of publicly financed research and development that is undertaken at a higher education institution and a science council if four requirements are met. These are if they contributed to the funding, if they were co-creation, if benefit sharing policies are in place, and if there's an agreement to commercialize. So if we took this practically, if we have a company, PTY Limited, that wants to work with the University of Pretoria, the PTY Limited can become a co-owner if the R&D was undertaken at the University of Pretoria. They co-fund it, and they, by funding, we mean it in the broadest terms. This can be background IP, this can be access to expertise, this can be access to infrastructure, access to library equipment, anything, funding in the broadest terms. If your PTY Limited co-created with the University of Pretoria, benefit sharing policies we know already in place, and if there is an agreement to commercialize, then co-ownership of publicly financed IP is possible. The last option is a full cost option. And this was brought in quite later in the negotiations of the Act. And I think it was specifically, I'm talking under correction, but I think it was Sasol that said, I work with universities a lot and I work with science councils a lot. How, what provisions needs to be put in place to make sure that the provisions of the IPR Act does not apply? And they came up with a full cost option. And it says that if R&D is undertaken at a higher educational science council and it is funded on a full cost basis by the private entity or organization, it is deemed to be not publicly financed and the IPR Act does not apply. All universities and science councils have a NIPMO approved indirect cost recovery rate, which says that if we take our direct costs, it's a percentage. This indirect cost recovery rate is a percentage that is levied against the direct costs. And if that is then levied, we know what is the full cost, is deemed to be the full cost of the project. If the private entity or organization pays that, it is deemed to be not publicly financed and it will fall outside the scope of the IPR Act. I just want to put a word of caution in here. Full cost R&D does not mean that the IP automatically belongs to the full cost funder. It just says that provisions of the IPR Act does not apply, and now the two parties can negotiate ownership. To put this all in an illustration, I try to do it like this. If we can talk you through from the top, we have a funding agency, which is, let's say, the Department of Science and Innovation. It funds an institution, if we go to the left, which is normally a higher education institution or a Science One institution, which is generally a science council. The institution can own that intellectual property, or if they work with a third party, they can co-own. Let's start again from the top. We have the Department of Science and Innovation. It funds a third party that is not a higher education institution or a science council. That third party, if it receives funding from the funding agency and it undertakes the research and development itself, it will own that intellectual property. If that third party now works with another entity, it can co-own that intellectual property via negotiations. I know this is a very complicated slide, and I will welcome further discussions and emails on this maybe after our presentation. Let's go to commercialization options that are available. Commercialization options are very wide, and it is what you negotiate it to be. Here are some options. We can have a technology transfer agency or broker that does the commercialization on your behalf. So you give your intellectual property to a broker who commercializes on your behalf. The advantage of this is, of course, that your agency or the agency has a good network of potential licensees and very often pulls intellectual property from various sources to make a product that is more attractive to commercialize. The second commercialization option is the direct sale of the product. You, as a company, make the product you make the product and sell it, or you sell your services. A third type of commercialization option is a research collaboration. You collaborate in terms of research, conclude a commercialization agreement, and commercialize your intellectual property. We have an open source route where various people can contribute to the same intellectual property on certain specific commercialization terms. We have an assignment or a sale of intellectual property. I'll go into that a little bit more detail on my next slide. And then we have a licensing option, which can be to an existing company or to a spin-out company. What's the difference between a license and an assignment? A license is an agreement between an IP owner, what we will call a licensor, and another third party, a licensee, in exchange for an agreed payment. There's a commercialization partner's granted part all of the rights to commercialize the IP. It's very important to remember that if you license your intellectual property, you retain ownership thereof. Licenses can be exclusive or non-exclusive. So exclusive licenses are those that are limited to a single commercial partner, whereas non-exclusive licenses allow for licensing to more than one commercial partner in respect of the same intellectual property. And then we have an assignment. An assignment where the ownership of that IP is transferred from one entity to another. And I want to pause here for a moment. In order for you to successfully use your intellectual property or to successfully commercialize intellectual property, it is not necessary for you to own that. You just need to have access to the IP to be able to successfully commercialize that intellectual property. So when you are considering collaboration or a commercialization strategy, always keep that in mind. With ownership comes extra responsibilities. You have to make sure that the patents are maintained. If it's a patent, you have to make sure that it is maintained. Renewal fees are paid, and so forth. A license gives you access to do certain things, provides you with certain rights, and is also an effective means to successfully commercialize a product. Other options, if you want to, is to license your intellectual property that you have to an existing company. The advantages of this is the company is already there. It's got a brand name, it's got market access, it's got established distribution channels, and the potential conflicts are less because you're just licensing your intellectual property to an existing company and they will take it forward. The disadvantages might be that it's difficult to get the attention of an existing company if your invention is still green. Existing companies also have their own research agenda and priorities, and if you don't fit into that, or if your intellectual property don't fit into that strategy, it's difficult to get someone to take it forward and to have that champion that you want. And then you always run the risk that the company will lose interest in your technology. Let's say you want to license to a spin-out company, or for that matter, start your own spin-out company. You will only start that spin-out company if you see there is a need in the market that's not being addressed and your company, or the spin-out company that you envisage, can do it. Advantages, of course, of licensing to a spin-out company or actually establishing your own is that a spin-out company will be dedicated to developing this intellectual property or your invention as its first priority. It will work closely with you because you are the expert and your expertise would be needed. You might actually be part of that spin-out company to make it a success. The disadvantages would be that we know the failure rates of spin-out companies in South Africa, and I believe, can't quote me on this, but I believe that is it one in every seven spin-out companies that establish that is being established is still successful and operational after, I think it's 5 or 7 years. So the failure rate is high. It's difficult to raise investment money. And it is difficult to establish that marketing and developing distribution channels and connections that are so desperately needed when you want to commercialize. So I'm not giving you an answer, but I'm trying to indicate what should be considered when and what options of commercialization you take. In terms of the IPR Act, there are certain approval requirements that is necessary. Should you want to have a license on a royalty-free basis, NIPMA approval is required for that. So the recipient, let's say, for example, it's the CSIR, if it wants to license intellectual property for free, it needs to apply to NIPMA for that transaction. Our turnaround period is 30 days. The same with an assignment. If we want to sell off, give away publicly financed intellectual property, that needs to have a NIPMA approval, local and foreign. And again, our turnaround time is 30 days. And I want to put this in the blue block. I want to read every word here because this is our intention and this is the way the office operates. Approval will not unreasonably be withheld. If you can demonstrate that the IP transaction in question is in the public interest, we generally grant approval. If you can show us that it can make a difference, that it can be to the benefit of the people of the Republic, we want that to happen because what we have to remember is with publicly financed IP, our tax money was used in that R&D. That R&D produced something, an intellectual property. We as taxpayers want to see it being successfully utilized or commercialized to the benefit of our Republic, be it extra income, be it job creation, be it an improvement in our health, poverty alleviation. And NIPMO will not stand in the way if we can see it's in the public interest. I want to quickly touch on IP collaboration. And I found this quote from Marshall Phelps. And he said, few, if any, companies today can hold all the pieces of their own product technology. Simply must collaborate with others if they want to survive and prosper. And intellectual property has become much more of a bridge to collaboration. And it comes back to what I said in the beginning. Patents or intellectual property is just a means. It's not the end. It is your key to opening the door to commercial success. I was very happy when Freddie made his remarks when he said we are moving into a new form of doing business. Previously, our product development cycle was integrated within one country, within one company. Now, we have many companies contributing to the product development. Points to ponder. When you are dealing with IP collaboration, there's no such thing as one size fits all. And as an office, we've been requested numerous times to create a template for collaboration. And we always say no. It is not only IP specific, It is technology specific. It is what your strategy is, commercial business strategy is. So no one size fits all. But please remember to think about your background intellectual property that you bring into this collaboration. What is it and how is it protected? Discuss upfront how we are going to deal with intellectual property. If we have joint intellectual property, how is it going to work? Who is going to pay? Who is going to reimburse each other? Choose who is going to be the commercialization lead. If you have too many cooks, it spoils the broth. Both parties cannot be a commercialization lead. One has to be appointed, and it has to be appointed for a limited time period. So that if that person is not successful and the time period is over, it can be renegotiated. And as Freddie has said, we are all in love with one another in the beginning, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, happy to collaborate with one another, super excited. But boy, oh boy, when the money starts flowing in, when we start talking about ownership, if it's not been dealt with while we were still in love, it will definitely not be dealt with when we hate each other. So if something has not been clarified, always make sure that you have appropriate dispute resolutions in place to try to resolve the issue with this marriage between the two parties. I want to end off with the NIPMO initiative that we have. It is called the Innovation Bridge Portal. It is an online portal that aims to accelerate connection and collaboration within the national system of innovation and encourage greater interaction with innovators, industry, and government in support of commercialization of technologies. If you go to this website, you can register as a user. You can put your technologies up for potential uptakers to look at. And if you have funding opportunities, you can look at them there as well. If you would allow me, I just want to quickly play you a short video of this innovation bridge portal.
There you go. Thank you once again for listening to our second podcast. For more information, you can contact us on our website, memsa.org.za, or you can send an email to admin@memsa.org.za. Thank you.